Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
How would you respond if God came to you one day and said, I want to teach your greatest enemy a lesson? Perhaps your first thought might be, well, he could certainly do with one. And you say to God, I like where this is going. What did you have in mind? And God says, I'm going to give him an example of faith and dedication that he can use as a model for his own life. I'm going to show him what a tremendously spiritual person you really are. And you think to yourself, wow, this sounds pretty good. And you say to God with your customary modesty, I'm happy to work with you. I want to help my enemy to learn his lesson. And God says, I'm so glad you feel that way. Because I'm going to start by taking away everything that you have ever loved and valued. I will remove every source of comfort and security from your life. I will remove not just the things that you've always wanted and enjoyed and hoarded, but also the things that you actually need and rely on. And suddenly, God's offer looks very different. When Job's life began to change for the worse, he was given no explanation. He wasn't asked for his opinion. He wasn't asked for his permission. He wasn't consulted in any way at all. Instead, he was expected to endure and overcome his trial using only his personal faith, his understanding of God's character, and his relationship with the Father. And superficially, this might not sound very difficult for Job, because we know he's described as a man unique for his time. We're told that in all his community, there was no one as faithful and dedicated and successful as Job. Job's life was an example of stability and consistency. People gained reassurance from his success. They said to themselves, well, here is the proof that God rewards the righteous. Perhaps if I apply myself, I might one day be like him. And because they knew Job to be a hard-working, principled, and disciplined man, they felt that he deserved everything that he had, and they didn't begrudge it. But what happened to this image of perfection when God began to unravel the seams of Job's life? How did this man of faith respond when those reassuring foundations of stability began to collapse? How did Job's friends and acquaintances and family respond to him? Let's take a look at Job chapter 1, just to establish the context. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was pure and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions included 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys. In addition, he had a very great household. Thus, he was one of the greatest people in the East. Now, his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one in turn. And they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. When the days of their feasting were finished, Job would send for them and sanctify them. He would get up early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job thought, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's customary practice. Now the day came when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also arrived among them. Yahweh said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered Yahweh, "From roving about on the earth and from walking back and forth across it." So Yahweh said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on the earth, a pure and upright man, one who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered Yahweh, "Is it for nothing that Job fears God? Have you not made a hedge around him and his household and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his livestock have increased. But extend your hand and strike everything he has, and he will no doubt curse you to your face." So Yahweh said to Satan, "All right then, everything he has is in your hand. Only do not extend your hand against the man himself." So Satan went out from the presence of Yahweh. This is a very interesting situation. I don't think we've got anything like it elsewhere in Scripture. The sons of God, by which I understand the assembly of believers, have come before God on a certain day, and among them is the adversary. He's a mysterious character. We don't know his name. We don't know his origins. We don't know his social status, his age, or his occupation. The Bible doesn't reveal his identity. Instead, it reveals his thoughts and his motivations. And I believe it does this because God wants us to understand what drives the adversary to do and say the things that he does and says. I think his identity is irrelevant. What we should be asking ourselves is, can I relate to this man? We can learn some things about the adversary. We can learn about him from the way he speaks to God. God asks him, "Where have you come from?" And he's told, "From walking to and fro in the earth." The adversary asserts his independence by refusing to answer God directly. There's a hint of pride and rebellion and self-assurance in the adversary's answer. God asks him, "Have you considered my servant Job?" And the adversary says, "Oh yes, I know Job. And I know his righteousness is false." So we know that the adversary is a slanderer, and he hates Job, seemingly without cause. We can also learn about the adversary from the way that he treats Job. I think it's interesting that the moment he receives power from God, he begins his attack. There's no hesitation here. There's no regret. There's no remorse. There's no guilt. The adversary behaves like a man who has just been given a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and he's determined to make the very most of it while it lasts. And look at what he does. Look at the various aspects of Job's life that are singled out for the adversary's special attention. In Job 1, verses 14 to 17, Job loses his income. In Job 1, verses 18 to 19, he loses nearly all of his family. In Job 2, chapter 7, Job loses his health. Now, these are three massive hits in a very short period of time, an unnatural period of time. Three amazing calamities that are just so dreadful, so painful, and so extensive in their damage that Job is instantly crippled by them. He has no time to recover between each one. And because of this, we know that his reaction is spontaneous. And I think that's exactly what the adversary was hoping to provoke, a spontaneous reaction. What is our spontaneous reaction to trial? What was Job's spontaneous reaction to trial? I think the adversary was hoping that Job would forget himself, would lose himself in the moment, in the pain. I think he was hoping that Job would forget his commitment to God, would throw up his hands and renounce God. But Job doesn't do this. He's stronger than that. The adversary, though, is a patient man. He sits down and he waits for Job to crack under the pressure. What does the adversary's behavior tell us about him? He hates Job violently, enough to humiliate and degrade him. Job was the greatest man in the East. But the adversary has reduced him to nothing. The adversary wants Job dead, really. But God won't allow that. So the adversary flexes the rules as much as he can. He strikes Job with a debilitating illness that makes Job wish for death. It's a cruel and cunning trick to play on Job. Oh, I can't kill him? I'll make him wish he was dead. Maybe he'll do the job for me. The adversary is so convinced that Job's prosperity has made him soft. He is so convinced that Job's righteousness is false that all he has to do is attack Job in this deep and personal and permanent way to watch his relationship with God fall apart. And the speed with which he attacks Job suggests he can barely restrain himself. It's as if there's this tidal wave of malice has been building up over the years, and it finally spills over Job. The adversary's attacks are specific and precise. There's nothing left to chance here. He has deliberately targeted Job's health, income, and social support. These are the three things that every human being needs for security and stability. With only one of them gone, we'll be uncomfortable, but we'll get by. With two of them gone, we will surely be in trouble. But with all three gone, we will certainly die. The way the adversary talks about Job suggests envy. And I believe he has taken away from Job all the things that he himself lacks, all the things that made Job's life comfortable, all the things that set him apart from other men and made him respectable. He does nothing which does not cause direct and immediate pain to Job. And I think this suggests evidence of careful planning. If indeed the adversary is taking from Job the things that he himself lacks, then he is revealing something of himself to us. If Job has lost health, income, and social support, stability, in short, then this suggests it is the one thing that the adversary has need of. Stability, the one thing the adversary envies the most. Because although there's a kind of swaggering bravado in the way that he addresses God, there's also a sense of aimlessness in the way that he passes his time. He wanders to and fro on the earth. He has nowhere to go. He has nowhere to stay. He moves constantly. There's no foundation in his life. There's no integrity to what he does. I think he's at war with himself. And consequently, he's at war with God. Perhaps he's had a bitter life, and it's left him a bitter man. If this is the case, it's no wonder he envies Job so deeply. And no wonder he wants him dead. He knows he can't reach up to Job's greatness. He can't meet Job on his own terms. So instead, he brings Job down to his level. "You think Job is righteous," he says to God. "But would he have been so righteous if he had lived my life instead of the one he enjoys now?" I think that's the implied question in the adversary's response to God and Job. And I think there is an implied answer in Ecclesiastes 7, verse 15. Let's go there now. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, commencing in verse 15. "During the days of my fleeting life, I have seen both of these things. Sometimes a righteous person dies prematurely, in spite of his righteousness. And sometimes a wicked person lives long, in spite of his evil deeds. So do not be excessively righteous, self-righteous, or excessively wise. Otherwise, you might be disappointed." I think the implied answer here is that God doesn't guarantee happy endings. God doesn't offer us traditional Hollywood narratives. He offers us life. And I don't know about you, but in my experience, life is pretty messy. It's full of unresolved issues, questions, problems, threads that never quite get sorted. It's not as simple as some kind of binary equation where we put in one thing and we know that we will always get out from it something else, something predictable. Sometimes good people suffer. Sometimes bad people flourish. This is the price we pay for free will. This is the cost of creation. The adversary is not willing to accept this. He thinks God is unfair. He thinks God chooses a few favorite people and simply discards the rest. He thinks God has no time for him because he's a sinner. "God doesn't want me," he says to himself. "I'm too problematic for him. He has no use for a man like me." If you're anything like me, and for your sake, I really hope you're not, you might have experienced similar thoughts in your life, where your relationship with God has broken down and you think, "What am I bringing to this relationship that God could possibly need or want or respect? God's love is immeasurable. I can't compete with that. Look at my life. It's all over the place. I did pretty well in maybe the 90s, and then early 2000s was a bit rocky, and Things picked up again around 2005. Not quite sure why. I had a good run there. But, you know, I just keep falling back into the same old habits, and it's two steps forward, one step back. Why does God bother? What am I bringing to this relationship? But with divine patience, I believe God shows that he desires a relationship with the adversary, because he extends himself to this man. He addresses his private concerns, even though they are wrong. He even goes so far as to accept the adversary's challenge and involve himself in a special trial of a righteous man for the sake of an unrighteous man. Because God knows that if the adversary can be proved wrong, it may be possible to win him back. It may be possible for this sinner to be reconciled. And I'm pretty sure that is something that we can personally relate to. So just like the adversary, God's actions tell us something too. They tell us of his mercy, his forbearance, his patience, and his wisdom. They tell us that even while he was not quite ready to speak to Job, not at this stage of the trial, he always maintained a dialogue with Job's adversary. He offered forgiveness and reconciliation. I think God did have time for this man, just as he does for all of us. And if you come with me to Genesis chapter 4, I think you'll find another sinner that God had time for. Genesis chapter 4, commencing in verse 8. Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out into the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother and killed him. Then Yahweh said to Cain, "Where is your brother, Abel?" And he replied, "I don't know. Am I my brother's guardian?" But Yahweh said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. So now you are banished from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you tried to cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its best for you. You will be a homeless wanderer on the earth." Then Cain said to Yahweh, "My punishment is too great to endure. Look, you are driving me off the land today, and I must hide from your presence. I will be a homeless wanderer on the earth. Whoever finds me will kill me." But Yahweh said to him, "All right then. If anyone kills Cain, Cain will be avenged seven times as much." Then Yahweh put a special mark on Cain so that no one who found him would strike him down. Here is an adversary just like Job's. He hates his brother without a cause. Perhaps there's still lingering resentment from the sacrifices they offered to God. Cain is perhaps envious. We know he is wrathful, and he kills his brother. When God asks him directly about Abel, his answer is evasive. "Am I my brother's guardian?" Cain comes across as strong-willed and confident, proudly asserting his independence from God. But his punishment is to walk to and fro upon the earth, to go up and down upon it without rest. Driven from his farm, he has lost his income. Cut off from his parents, he has lost any form of social support. known in his community as a murderer, he now fears for his own life. This is an unstable man, aimless and desperate, but God intervenes. He places a mark upon Cain so that he might live, and in living, learn his lesson. A lesson about the need to be merciful, even to those who have shown no mercy. A lesson about the need to turn from evil and choose good. Can we see these similarities between Cain and Job's own adversary? And if so, can we also see the similarities between these men and ourselves? Do we have the honesty to admit that really, deep down inside, where it counts, we are not so very different? Sometimes we envy. But when we envy, we often hate also. And Jesus said that when we hate, we have effectively killed. We become murderers. Sometimes we lust. But when we lust, we indulge our desires. And Jesus said that when we indulge our desires, we commit adultery in the heart. We can speak to God at any time about these things. He's always open. He's always listening. But when we do speak to him, do we speak directly? Or do we hold something back, pretending that what we don't say can't ever be known or acknowledged? How much do we confess to God on Sunday morning as we take the emblems? How powerful are those emblems to us as we look at them? Can we see the body of Christ in the bread? Can we see the blood of Christ in the wine? When we contemplate the emblems and what they represent, do we open our hearts to God in search of true reconciliation? Or do we just skim the week, review a few bad points and say, well, at least I didn't commit any carnal abominations, and pacify our conscience for a week? Just quietly knock it into submission. Surely we can't afford to hold anything back, because if, like Job's adversary, we begin to distance ourselves from God, we will become just as bitter and dysfunctional as he did. We will know intellectually that we need God, and Job's adversary knew it too. But he couldn't bring himself to admit it. He presents a facade of independence and strength and acts as if he even enjoys wandering the earth. But in reality, he does want to settle. He wants to be secure. He wants to establish a foundation on which a good life can be built. And we know this because no matter how far he wanders, no matter how far he is from the assembly of the sons of God, something always drags him back. And that something is the consistency of God, the stability that only a relationship with him can offer. So whenever God's children are assembled, the adversary is there, on the fringe, wanting to join, but unable to pay the price. The price is humility, submission to God at the expense of our pride. Who of us here does not know just how terribly high that price can really be. So the adversary vents his frustration on Job. And at the outset, Job seems to respond pretty well. Look at Job 1, verse 20. Then Job got up and tore his robe. He shaved his head and he threw himself down with his face to the ground. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. Yahweh gives and Yahweh takes away. May the name of Yahweh be blessed." In all this, Job did not sin, nor did he charge God with moral impropriety. In the next chapter, Job continues his upright stance. He continues this acquiescence to the will of God. He maintains his integrity, even though the pain is really starting to hurt now. Look at Job chapter 2, verse 9. Job's wife said to him, "Are you still holding firmly to your integrity? Curse God and die." But Job replied, "You're talking like one of the godless women would do. Should we receive what is good from God and not also receive what is evil?" In all this, Job did not sin by what he said. Job's wife is probably responding the way most of us would, the way Job would if he wasn't such an amazing guy. Job's wife is in pain because her husband is in pain and because her life has been ruined in the destruction of his own. It's difficult to see how this marriage can survive. Job can't even communicate with his wife. They can't even discuss this issue. It's so painful. We can't afford to be too self-righteous about Job's wife, because we know that we ourselves are the bride of Christ and we forsake him whenever we sin. We promised to be true to him, we made our vows, and we enjoy the new life that he's given us, and yes, we want everyone to know about it. But occasionally, when pride rises within us, we turn our faces from the pain and suffering that Jesus endured for our sake. We drop our eyes from his sacrifice, and like Peter, we deny our Lord. Job chapter 2 is the last time we hear about the adversary. He just disappears from the record without explanation. We can speculate endlessly about what happened next. Was he convinced? Did he repent? Did he rebuild his own relationship with God? I believe we're not told because we don't need to know. The adversary has played his part in our understanding of events. Now the focus needs to shift to Job. The rest of his story involves a series of arguments recorded in painstaking detail. Every aspect of Job's suffering is turned over, cross-examined, and thrashed out by six different people. Job, his three friends, Elihu the Buzzite, and God. The inspired writer of this book has deliberately given us multiple perspectives on the case of Job. He treats us like a jury panel, laying out the evidence and inviting our judgment. This suggests that on a personal level, the most important response to Job's trial is ours. Job's response to his trial is a complex one, which goes through a number of stages. At first, he's calm because he's in shock. Next, he tries to rationalize his situation. If he can just get his head around it, it will start to make sense. He needs to get over his emotional reaction so that his intellectual reaction can begin. And once this is done, he begins to analyze. Initially, he submits to God. He's willing to endure suffering because he is sure there's a reason behind this. And he's sure that God will reveal it very soon. He trusts God. He accepts what's happening. He waits patiently for an explanation. But by the time his three friends arrive, no explanation has come. Job is mystified by this. It's not what he expected. And so he slips into resignation. He reaches the point at which he doesn't even care why this is happening. He just wants it to stop. As his pain continues, as his friends challenge him without resolution, Job's frustration bubbles to the surface, and he accuses God of dragging out this trial unnecessarily. Job is hurting because he expected God to explain the situation, and God has not. Job emphasizes the isolation that he feels. He paints God as a distant figure who takes little interest in his creation. And finally, Job says, "Do what you like with me, God. I don't care anymore." But the next phase Job enters is reflection. He has to reconsider as his friends lay out their arguments. He looks back, he turns things over in his mind, and he begins to see his problem in a slightly different light. His friends have offered their perspective, their theories about what might be going on. Job doesn't agree, but it's given him more to think about. Yet the more he thinks, the further he slides into bitterness, which is the next phase of his response. "I don't deserve this. God's too hard on me. I was given no warning. I was given no explanation. What's the point of all this?" As Job mourns the loss of his relationship with God and the riches he had when life was stable, as his friends press him harder, Job switches to a position of self-righteousness. And he tries to justify himself. In chapter 29, he presents a long list of all his righteous acts and all the blessings that he had since God began to afflict him. And it hurts him so much that he lists them again in chapter 30. And he lists them again in chapter 31. He says, "When I took my seat at the gate, the young men humbled themselves because they saw me as a leader. The old men rose to meet me. They saw me as a peer. The princes stopped talking because they saw me as one who spoke wisdom. The nobles waited to hear me because they saw me as a counselor. I was not just one of the men who sat at the gate. I was the man who sat at the gate. I was the man who delivered the poor. I was the man who visited the widows and the fatherless. I was the man who guided the blind and supported the lame. I was the man who did everything around here." What Job says is true, to a point. And all he's doing here is listing his virtues to defend himself against the accusation of unrighteousness. But he goes one step too far. He presents himself as the rock upon which his entire community rested. And now when he mourns, it's not his relationship with God, but his social status that he mourns the most. He concentrates more on the advantages of his position than the simple exaltation that his righteous life provided. I think this has happened because the words of his friends have finally worn him down. He seems to confess that he resents the passing of his former glory because to a certain extent he considered it a right rather than a privilege. He confesses to a secret fear, which he hints at in chapter 3, 25. He says, "The very thing I dreaded has happened to me." He doesn't tell us exactly what this is, but it's not hard to guess. Job thinks that the loss of his prosperity has destroyed his credibility. He's afraid that the members of his community will think some private sin has laid him low. He believes his influence and authority will be lost forever. Perhaps in the back of his mind, he doubts that his brethren and sisters are able to look past his wealth and see a spiritual man. "Did they only listen to me because I was successful? Was that what was most important to them?" If that's the case, how much of this was my fault? Have I failed to develop a relationship with the people who meant so much to me? The people that I was even assisting? No one can deny that Job worked hard in his community. But he doesn't react well when God changes his role. Job used to be a burden bearer, a shoulder. He took half the load in his community. Now he's just a toe. One of 10 small, uncomely parts. Perhaps for the very first time he gained an understanding of the people he has supported for so long. He realizes that they too are worthy of respect and that they too have a contribution to make. As a shoulder, Job bore the load in his community. As a toe, he must now learn that it is his duty to provide balance for the body. But in his desperation to prove that he's a righteous man, in chapter 29, he makes a crucial error. He neglects the role of God in his life. He resents the loss of prosperity and reputation. He fails to acknowledge that it was God who set him up in this role. He claims he can do nothing more in his community because God has brought him too low. But of course, that's untrue. Job speaks of the time when the Almighty was with me. But his mistake is in assuming that God has ever left. He says men no longer respect him, but he forgets that in God's eyes he hasn't changed. God still sees the same person. There's no reason why he can't still lead a productive life. And I think that's the hardest step for Job to take. And I think most of us can relate to this. I think we all have our stories of pain and disappointment. But even if our lives have not turned out in the way that we'd hoped, we must realize that we have no right to make demands on God. We proclaim his righteousness when we resign ourselves to our current circumstances and submit to the life he has decided we must have. Because if we do not, we will repeat the sin of Job and Moses in claiming that it is by our own power that we have brought water from the rock. The tipping point for Job comes when Elihu, the youngest of his friends, speaks up. Elihu had the courage and perception to shake Job out of his self-pity and rebuke the other men for failing to answer Job's questions. The key to Elihu's argument is relevance. Job and his friends spend chapter after chapter talking past each other, never quite seeing eye to eye, assuming they're talking about the same thing while never actually connecting. And Job is utterly frustrated with this. He reaches the point where he says, "You're not even listening, so why don't I finish my speech and then you can just mock me some more?" But when Job does finish, his three friends are silent. And finally, Elihu steps in. Elihu is angry in ways you can't even begin to imagine. He says to Job, "I'm angry with you because you claim that God has no right to interfere with your life in this way. You're accusing him of injustice." And he says to the three friends, "I'm angry with you because you've condemned Job as an unrepentant sinner. But you can't find any fault in him. You can't even answer his questions." Elihu says, "No one is standing up for God here. You're misrepresenting God. You've got a flawed understanding of God. This is why you can't solve this." And he's so angry, he manages to talk for the next six chapters without interruption. Elihu's response to Job is very interesting because he quotes him directly. Job had said, "Man cannot strive with God." And Elihu says, "So why do you fight him?" Job said, "I cannot see God in my life." And Elihu says, "Well, you say you do not perceive him, but you're looking in the wrong way, in the wrong place." Job says, "Oh, the innocent are mocked. There's no point in being virtuous." Elihu says, "No, God does repay us for our works." Job says, "Oh, I'm nothing. God can return me to dust." Elihu says, "Well, don't think you're so special. God can return us all to dust." Job says, "I know that I am right." And Elihu says, "Yeah, I hear you. Job says I am innocent." Job says, "The wicked escape punishment." Elihu says, "No, the wicked are punished. Perhaps not now. Perhaps not in the way you expect. But ultimately, we do receive our righteous reward from God." You see, Elihu is angry because God has been misrepresented by Job's friends who claim that God never lets bad things happen to good people. Bad things only happen to people who deserve them. Elihu is angry because God has been misrepresented by Job, who claimed God was treating him unfairly. And from this we see that both Job and his friends shared the same flawed view of God. Elihu shows that their attitude actually disrespects God by oversimplifying his character. Elihu says to Job, "Your answers are like the answers of wicked men. They will be emboldened by your response. They will say, 'Oh, I remember what Job said when he went through his trial. I'm going to echo Job's words.' Wicked men will take advantage of this situation, Job. You're denying everything that I know God to be." But his speech is not entirely negative. He points out that God still wants to work with Job, and that Job can and should still work in his community. Elihu calls Job to self-examination. Job is forced to confess that he's misjudged God's role in his life. He learns that there is no flaw or personal defect buried so deep within us that trial and temptation are unable to bring it to the surface. And it's interesting that when God finally does speak to Job, he reiterates much of what Elihu has said. "You were wrong to doubt me," says God, "because by doubting me, you doubted my righteousness." Job is reconciled to God and he's reconciled to his friends. But it's interesting that this only occurs after he's offered sacrifices for them. Only after he has truly forgiven them does his life change for the better. Yet, remember that God did not promise this. The final test of Job's faith was seen in the many years it took for his prosperity to be regained. This required faith in God and work on Job's behalf, work in the new role, the reduced role that he had in his community. He had to continue as a toe in his community for a very long time before he was made a shoulder again. Job 42 finishes very quickly, and it's easy to skim through those closing verses and assume that Job's fortunes were practically restored overnight. He looked out across the breakfast table and there was the Middle Eastern UPS delivering 7,000 camels. Oh, great, the camels are here. Good. Put them with the donkeys at the back, thank you. Oh, we've got children now. Oh, great. We've got a whole stack of new children. Where do they come from? Well, hazard a guess. It wasn't an overnight restoration. Job had to repair his relationship with his wife before he could even start a new family. But it's to their credit that they're still married. That relationship survived. How amazing is that? How long does it take to repair a relationship which was so badly damaged that his wife was advising him to curse God and die in chapter 2? How long does it take to raise a family of 10 children? I've only got two and it already feels like forever. How long does it take to literally double your assets and turn a bankrupt family business around into a market leader once again? It takes time. It takes faith and commitment. And it doesn't happen without the blessing of God. It doesn't happen without a relationship with God. So there was a long period of hardship that had to be endured before Job's fortunes were restored. And this was a time for him to reflect on what he had learned. A time for him to serve his community in less obvious, less prestigious ways. And that was the final test of his faith. To slowly rebuild, regroup, and recover. What else do we learn from Job's experience? We often like to say that life is fair or unfair. I don't think that's right. Life is neither fair nor unfair. Life just is. What matters is how we respond to it. Our challenge is to endure suffering without blaming God. It's not always his fault. Sometimes bad things just happen. Rediscovering God is a healing process. Bad things do happen to good people, and others learn from our response. Finally, trial hurts God too, mainly because of the way we respond to it. Do we respond to trial in a way that damages our relationship with God, that damages other people's perception of him? Or do we accept that he does have something better for us? And that a time of trial is also another way to develop our relationship with God and potentially to rediscover him.